Interestingly, to the person, all my colleagues in South Korea said that the emphasis for South Koreans right now has shifted away from the peace process with North Korea and onto the South Korean economy. Job reports came out, economic indicators came out. The South Korean economy needs a desperate shot in the arm. At the same time, the South Koreans and North Koreans held family reunions for the first time in 3 years and really gripped the nation's attention when once again these truly tragic stories dominate the news cycle to tell of families that have been ripped apart for now 73 years. People did not expect, anticipate in any way that the border would remain so rigid. They fled during war, often picking one sibling who was smaller, leaving boys behind with fathers. But really, these stories played out again. So while South Koreans were on the street concerned about their economic realities, they were also aware that this larger process is still very much dominating their atmosphere. President Moon is really trying to hold a balance by saying, well, we need to move forward with South Korea's economic principles. The nation's companies are largely helping him in this regard. Samsung pledging hundreds of thousands of new jobs, POSCO Steel, hundreds of thousands of new jobs, in an effort to really keep South Koreans actively engaged in the broader picture, which is the peace process with North Korea and what that means for the region and the world.
On the peace process, there's been much changed on that as well, with the scheduled visit by Secretary of State Pompeo back to Korea being changed, and the question of the declaration of the formal end of the war that is still exists before denuclearization could take place. And then reports that Kim Jong-un would like to have all this taken care of while President Trump is still in office. I know as a historian you tend to want to look back at what's happened and analyze, but in real time, what do you see?
I think both Kim Jong-un and President Trump recognize a similar method of dealing with problems in one another, which is they want the spotlight, they want to grab it, and they see a chance. This has all of their handlers, all of the people who've made an industry out of so-called alliance management, managing North Korean tensions, very nervous. Arguably for good reasons. There's a deep history of North Korean leaders making promises and then not fulfilling them. At the same time, there's also a deep history of the United States, South Korea, Japan making promises that have failed to be fulfilled, thus creating the conditions for North Korea to forge ahead with its nuclear program. If Kim Jong-un could tweet, I think he would love to be able to tweet the way Donald Trump does. He is not in a position to have that kind of access to social media transmission, but he's making similar kinds of bold statements to his own people. He's quoted as saying the other day, he personally has never spoken ill of Donald Trump. This lands at a moment when the American news cycle is dominated by the impending publication of Bob Woodward's book, with lots of people speaking ill of Donald Trump, and we know that Donald Trump would prefer to work with someone who's only going to praise him. The two men have really met one another and I think arguably have decided that this is their chance. If there is any success taken away from the Singapore moment, which has been derided for a host of reasons, Kim Jong-un now finds himself in a position in which, were he to launch a ballistic missile or conduct a nuclear test, he would lose international approval for even the smallest of efforts that he and his government appear to be trying to make to re-enter the world community. In the meantime, the South Koreans would like to be able to control this process more than the pullback that seems to be happening from Washington now. I landed literally as the announcement of Secretary Pompeo's trip being postponed was taking place. So colleagues with whom I met the next day who'd been planning to meet with Secretary Pompeo said, well, you know, we're just getting used to this. We're getting used to Trump's grandstanding and we'll just now play wait and see. In that same moment, they still are going ahead with the North-South process on their own. The problem is, for all intents and purposes, the United States really does control this situation. But President Moon will be flying to Pyongyang, and I think it would be very much in Kim Jong-un's interest requests to give him a list of North Korea's nuclear capabilities, facilities, where the weapons are, how many there are. Do I expect it to be full? No, that would be not in his state's interest, but something more than just a commitment to denuclearization is going to be necessary to convince the hardliners in Washington to give a little to South Korea and move forward with the process.
In looking at the apparent reduction of tension in the region of the Korean Peninsula, Professor Dudden notes that Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has proposed increasing his military budget.
Now, many Japanese find this perplexing because if, in fact, there's a chance to defuse the potential for war in the region, why commit so much of Japan's budget to a weapon system that, if North Korea isn't going to be the threat, then what are we really talking about? And I think that's what a lot of this is really bringing into relief, that this, all of this North Korea threat theory, all of this North Korea is the, you know, the existential threat to world peace, really is laying bare that the region internationally is repositioning itself vis-a-vis a rising China. And so that's really the larger thing that Japanese are concerned with. And so North Korea is a very small piece in that much larger future being imagined.
But we've also talked about the fact that the United States thinks that when peace is finally declared, their military presence will be less, possibly lessened as a result of that. And that affects United States security, as we've been learning from some of the Woodward information that that the president was asking, why do we need to be here for these things?
Exactly. And what's really interesting is that while for the first time, and if it's true, then it is rather startling, Kim Jong-un apparently the other day said to his South Korean counterparts, to the South Korean negotiators, that a peace declaration for the Korean Peninsula does not necessitate the withdrawal of the 28,500 American troops stationed in South Korea. Now, no North Korean leader has said that. In fact, it's usually been the opposite. So I think what, again, I can't answer for Kim Jong-un. He doesn't write much. And so as a historian, it's difficult to gauge what's actually going on, other than clearly he's allowed some information to be played on state media that positively portrays peace efforts. Now, again, does that mean he's giving up his nuclear weapons? No. But he's saying that the U.S. does not have to withdraw its troops. So, you know, we have a nuclear umbrella, in effect, for South Korea, and that justifies for North Korea their maintenance of a nuclear capability. If South Korea and North Korea are able to achieve a more stabilized detente in the form of a declaration to end the Korean War, that doesn't immediately overnight mean unified Korea. And I think that's a stumbling block that a lot of people who've been working in this field for a long time keep having and keep not making clear, is that Koreans today, especially younger South Koreans, are not asking for unification. They're asking for a stable two-state system until the situation can be dialed down, until there can be economic integration between North and South. We're not talking about a one Korea the way that for much of the past 70 years, we really have been talking about. And I think Kim Jong-un is acknowledging that if, in fact, he did say, well, U.S. can keep their troops, we're going to keep our army, but it doesn't mean we're going to go to war tonight. From my perspective, the most important thing to do is to figure out how to dial the tension down so that there is no error made that leads to a military scenario that would only be catastrophic. There is no minimal small-scale war that would be fought in the event of something terrible like that. It would be a very large event, very drastically and fast. It's not a question of who wins. That's all been played out. But it's a question of avoiding that with guarantees such as security agreements, regime survival agreements, which can best be done through an end to the Korean War. Then we move forward.